This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, as part of our Lawyers You'll Like series, we'll talk with attorney Brigid Keller.
Brigid directs the National Police Accountability Project, and she's got a lot to say about policing in America, and particularly stop and frisk in New York City.
We'll also hear from Anna Culcutt from New Yorkers Against the Cornell Technion Partnership.
It comes from that recently held panel discussion called Militarizing Domestic Spying and the Boycott of Israel.
Stay with us.
City Attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi, you and I were together at the National Lawyers Guild convention in San Juan, Puerto Rico 3 weeks ago, and we heard the most beautiful letter from Lynn Stewart read by her husband Ralph Poynter, Thanksgiving message. As our listeners may know, Lynn, who's 73 years old, is doing a 10-year sentence in a federal prison in Texas for essentially releasing a press release that got the Court of Appeals here in New York so upset that they ordered the judge who sentenced her to 28 months to give her 10 years. She was recovering from cancer at that time. She's had a relapse, stage 4 breast cancer. It's spread. She's asked for a compassionate release, which is the law, and the head of the Bureau of Prisons, Samuels, has so far refused to do it, although the head of the prison where she's in Carswell, and the doctors down there and her own doctors say she doesn't have that much longer to live. With that in mind, please read the letter that she wrote to us.
Brothers and sisters of the National Lawyers Guild, I wanted to send you this most important health bulletin, not personal, but on the steady evisceration of the right to counsel, the bulwark of all we do. Within the last weeks, a suspect was forcibly detained for crimes against the U.S. He was taken from Libya to an offshore ship where he was being interrogated, read tortured. When the public defenders of the Southern District of New York, where his case is ostensibly pending, attempted to have counsel appointed for him, they were turned down in no uncertain terms by judges using the now all too common weasel words. But this is not a new phenomenon. It is apparent over and over again, and the question remains, what are we, who claim to be the last protection against an overreaching state, going to do about it? How important is this? I need to tell a couple of anecdotes about lawyering. My dear deceased friend Bill Kunstler, in the tumultuous years in which the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force was rounding up the remnants of the Underground, Sekou Odinga, a member of the Black Panthers, and then the Black Liberation Army, related to me that he had been detained in a Queens, New York City precinct for many hours, was being waterboarded by the police in one of the toilets, and was really feeling it badly when all at once he heard the booming voice of the great Kunstler echoing through the hallways, demanding to see his client, and he knew that he had been saved. The other story was one that I told at an earlier convention, and a young lawyer from San Diego wrote to tell me it had turned her life around. After my arrest, Ralph and I were stuck in Manhattan traffic when a bicycle messenger pulled up and tapped on the window. When I opened it, he said in an excited and joyous voice, "You, the lawyer! You, the lawyer!" Indeed I was, and indeed it was and is my greatest ambition and accomplishment to be the lawyer. Back in the day, and I mean way back, when this adversary system had its origins, the accused had the right to select a champion to fight for their rights, and I mean fight, jousting, swordplay, mace and chain. Okay, perhaps a little hyperbole, but the message is clear. We were hired for our brawn as well as brains, our courage as well as legal acumen. We need to get courage and creativity in combat back into the equation. It's not about schmoozing the prosecution or the judge. How many courtrooms have I walked into where there was not one friendly face? There was just me and the client. Even the stenographers were hostile. And that's okay, because I was there for only one reason, the one I took an oath to zealously pursue, the defense of my client. Was it fearsome personally? Of course. But to do otherwise was more so. I urge everyone to return to the days of robust lawyering. Be Bill Kunstler in the precinct. Be the lawyer. Be the champion who defends fearlessly. When I say that the right to counsel is being eviscerated, I mean that the forces of the empire are very busy removing the nerves, the hearts, and the guts of the Fifth Amendment and leaving it a shell of what it was and can be. We are the opposition that need to gather our shields and swords in its defense and be selfless and brave. Let us press forward. Instead of the derision we often face, let us all strive to be the lawyer, respected and honored. Lynn Stewart.
Thank you, Heidi, for reading Lynn's letter to the National Lawyers Guild Convention.
And I'd like to thank Ralph Pointer for the beautiful reading that he gave in Puerto Rico.
You can protest Lynn's incarceration and demand her freedom by going to lynnstewart.org or lawanddisorder.org and get the phone number, the address of Prison Director Samuels.
Lawyers You'll Like series, we're joined today by attorney Brigid Keller. She's the executive director of the National Police Accountability Project. Brigid holds a law degree from Freiburg University Law School in her native Switzerland and an LLM from Boston University. She is admitted to practice law in New York. Prior to attending law school, Brigid counseled victims of domestic violence and was instrumental in founding the Swiss National Council of Women's Shelters. In addition to her engagement at NPAP, Brigid is a fellow at the International Center for Conciliation and occasionally teaches conflict resolution workshops. Welcome, Brigid, to Law and Disorder.
Heidi, thank you very much for having NPP on the show.
As executive director of the National Police Accountability Project, you work with some of the country's leading police misconduct attorneys. Tell us what NPAP does.
NPAP's mission is to hold law enforcement officers, including prison personnel, accountable for civil rights violations and police misconduct and brutality. And we have to distinguish between our attorney members who are litigating cases and then what we do and as NPAP, as an organization. And as an organization, we provide training and support to civil rights attorneys, legal workers, and community activists. We provide our members with an online forum to share their cases and discuss strategies and provide each other with the necessary support. Because as you know, this field of law is fairly complicated. And we also work with similar organizations on efforts to change policy and practices and provide relevant information to the public.
I'm actually on the NPAP listserv, and I must say that every day it's so fascinating to read really specific information about cases. And one of the subjects that comes up a lot is the use of tasers or other less lethal munitions. Tell us about some of the trends that you see in policing, and also what issues do you think are the most urgent right now?
One of the issues that I want to focus on a little bit is really that I think what we see are increasingly disproportionate measures taken by police. And this really permeates everything. And, you know, the Floyd case is actually...
And that's the New York stop and frisk case.
The New York stop and frisk case is actually a good example. You know, the police no longer stop individual people when there is reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. They preventively sweep up 100,000 of mostly young men of color based on the color of their skin. Another example is the use of firearms. where we increasingly see cases where police officers shoot unarmed civilians for in really cases where there are many, many questions whether the use of a firearm was at all justified. And also, in addition, whether the police officer actually, his actions really led to a situation where he or she felt the need to use the firearm. Another example, a final example that I would like to make to this point is the use of taser. When tasers were initially brought on the market, they were really sold to the public with the argument that they would be used instead of firearms. What we observe today, and this is really counts for all over the country, is that tasers are used in cases where there would never ever be a justification for the use of a firearm. They're used punitive, if people don't follow commands, but where there is really no reason to use a taser. And so I believe this is really an issue that the disproportionate measures used by officers is really a big problem.
And we've seen that with the National Lawyers Guild as we monitor police activities at mass assemblies, the use of tasers and many other forms of less lethal munitions, such as rubber bullets, tear gas. These are becoming routine parts of the arsenals that police use against passive protesters and onlookers.
Yeah. Or a pepper spray in a Davis case where the officer, from a very short distance, sprayed people in the face, people who were just peacefully sitting on the ground.
To me, since 9/11, is the beefing up for the police to really militarize them, mm-hmm. and the coordination of the police mm-hmm. with the federal mm-hmm. repressive forces. Mm-hmm. What's your take on that?
Well, I think it's an enormous problem because it really, when you think about why should we have police, is really to protect the people of this country. But the police behave like a military force. And I think victims of racial profiling in the Floyd context really, they expressed that they felt like an occupying army was descending on their neighborhoods. And this, I believe, is really an enormous problem and puts a divide between the community and the police, and even deeper divide than had already existed.
One of the things that you mentioned to me in the last day or so was that right after the court came in and reversed the judge's decision in Floyd, you were at your local subway stop where before you had seen tables of police officers, but they never stopped anyone. And what happened the other day?
So it was Monday morning, and I went to the train station. I opened the door, took out my card, my Metro card, and an officer stopped me and said, and the second officer was very close to him, and said to me, "We want to search your bag." And I said, "I do not consent to this search." And the officers said, "Well, then you have to leave the station." Which I did. I said, no problem, I will leave the station. But it was important to me to make this point, to really say, I do not consent to this search. I will not let me look into my bags. Because to me, this happening after the Floyd decision coming down, it was almost as if the Bloomberg administration and Commissioner Kelly wanted to make a point in saying, now this decision came down, and now we tell you what we can do, what we can continue to do.
Well, I liked your description of the police as an occupying army, because I think that's the way a lot of people in New York City who are affected by them, 700,000 young people, mostly Black and Latino, 87% of those people who are stopped by the cops coming out of their apartment building, walking down the street, coming home from school, going to school, routinely, regularly. We've interviewed these young people in our show, and they're not going to cooperate with the cops, not after that. So it doesn't lead to effective policing. It's counterproductive. Mm-hmm. But my question to you is, when the Second Circuit overturned the judge's quite intelligent ruling that there should be a stop to this because it's illegal, and that the police should work with the community, not against them. And the Second Circuit overturned it. It was Judge Walker, the same judge who's Bush's cousin, incidentally, the same judge that increased Lynn Stewart's sentence. He ordered Judge Codal to increase Lynn's sentence from 28 months to 10 years. That judge did it, and they took the case away from the original judge, and now we don't know where it stands. What's your opinion of the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit here in New York in doing that? What forces do they represent with respect to this occupying army paradigm?
Well, you know, I was shocked by the recusal of the judge. I mean, that was really something that I guess nobody really saw coming. The stay of the remedy part of the opinion was not as surprising, but still very, very disappointing. And I really think that because it was such an intelligent and such a thorough and such a creative remedy opinion, I really think that is something that was just too progressive for the Second Circuit. Judge Jindlin ruled that the community should be involved in defining the remedies. And I think it's still the case that a lot of people, it goes a little bit also into public perception of police misconduct. And I think there are still people who believe that our safety depends on police measures that actually include the violation of civil rights.
Yeah.
And so I believe that the opinion of the Second Circuit is a reflection of that attitude that if we want to be safe, some people actually have to have some inconveniences. And unfortunately, because as Judge Jindlin also said in her opinion, it's the racial profiling that makes it unconstitutional, and which basically means a lot of people, white people, like the judges, do not have this experience. They're not exposed to this police force that descends like an army on their neighborhood.
Brigitte Keller from the National Police Accountability Project, would you agree with me that that kind of racial profiling and overwhelming harassment of essentially working class communities in New York is not productive of keeping the streets safe, keeping crime low, but is actually counterproductive?
I would absolutely agree with that statement. And there is also, I mean, there is actually research done. There was research done on that subject that makes clear young men of color do not mind if they are stopped when they did something wrong. Research shows that young men of color have a very good sense for when policing is legitimate and when it is not legitimate. And this research, it goes to the same examples as CCR in their report, actually, when young people say how demeaning and the stop was. That was really something that came out in this research as well.
And Brigitte, you're referring to the Center for Constitutional Rights report from 2013 that deals with the human cost of stop and frisk.
Yes, correct. And in this case, you know, stopping 100,000 of young men without having an individualized suspicion of criminal activity is a problem because it's not legitimate. And these young people know this exactly. I think it's really important to recognize these strategies make the community very unsafe because, as you said before, previously, people will not call the police if the police behaves like an occupying army.
So you mean they won't call them if a crime is committed?
If a crime is happening. And I mean, we all know that we all know that crimes are happening and people should feel comfortable calling the police, and the police should respond in a constitutional way and in a constructive way to help people who are victims of crimes.
Yeah, because, you know, if you think about it, unless a police officer actually sees a crime being committed, the only way they're going to stop a crime or prosecute a crime is if they get cooperation from the community. By alienating the people that they're supposed to protect, they're making the situation in the streets more dangerous. And the other thing is, if they stop a kid and the kid protests, that would be the natural reaction if you're unfairly stopped to say this is not fair. Then you can get cited for disorderly conduct or mm-hmm. disrupting the operation of the government. You can get a misdemeanor mm-hmm. and then go try to find a job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to also just mention in a larger context that NPAP, not only does its members litigate cases with good measure of success, but you also do work with other groups and in the communities. And in the Chicago torture cases, which we've covered a lot with Flint Taylor and others on this show, NPAP members in Chicago, didn't they work with activists?
Yes, yes. They certainly did work with activists and with the community, and it clearly had an impact, and it made the Chicago torture cases really cases that came to be known all around the country. And so I think, and I really want to say at this point, that I find the involvement of community activists and families of victims incredibly important. So these activists and families do a tremendous amount of very important work. There is a different awareness, I believe, than today in the public at large about police misconduct, and it is not to a small measure thanks to the efforts, the tireless efforts of community activists and victims' families, that this has really come into the public space. And so we have many of our member attorneys are working with community groups together, and I think it's a very important strategy to do that.
Brigid, we're speaking with you the day after the elections for mayor in New York City. De Blasio, of course, was elected overwhelmingly. It was a real blowout. And he has pledged to get rid of the stop and frisk. In fact, I think that that's probably the main reason why people voted for him. And the case is on appeal. But if the city, if he's the new mayor rather than Bloomberg, he can pull the rug right out from under the reactionary forces and the police department, and they could start working with the community rather than against it. And I hope that happens. But I have to say that I'm not totally sanguine that that's going to happen. And what's your feeling about where we go from here?
I mean, I certainly also hope Mayor de Blasio will keep his promises that he made during his campaign and will withdraw the appeal in the Floyd case so that the remedies that Judge Schindlin ordered can be implemented. I agree with you that often, you know, it's easier to make promises during a campaign than sticking to them once you are in the position. And that's also because there is a lot of pressure. There will be a lot of pressure on the mayor to maybe be not quite that hard on the police. And so we will have to see. I hope that Mayor de Blasio will stick to his promises that he made during the campaign, and I hope that the remedies, including community involvement, which I find very, very important, will be implemented eventually. Even though this may happen, I really want to make clear that damage has been done already by the fact that the judge was recused from the case with, in my opinion, no valid reason. And second, because now, as opposed to the remedies being implemented right away, the police are allowed to continue to violate the rights of New Yorkers until the stay will be lifted. So damage has already been done, even if the mayor will do what he promised to do.
Brigid Keller, you're originally not from the United States. You went to law school in Switzerland. Heidi and I are just amazed at the long path that you've taken from there to here and what you're doing. Tell us a little bit about what's behind it and your own personal story.
So I did go to law school in Switzerland, and I have an LLM from BU, and I'm actually admitted to practice law here in New York. So my way to the law was, you know, a long way, actually. I did other things before. I came from early childhood education through social work. I came to be a lawyer. My interest in the law really started initially by working for 7 years in a shelter for domestic violence victims. You know, it's interesting, if I may say, that there are some parallels between how domestic violence was viewed when I worked in that field and how, and the perception of police misconduct. You know, there are some similarities, like, you know, the public at large blaming the victim. You know, you must have done something wrong to become a victim of domestic violence, or in alternative, to become a victim of police misconduct. So I find this an interesting parallel.
And specifically, many of us are also fascinated by issues related to police practices. Why did that appeal to you?
As a political person and taking part in demonstrations in Switzerland against nuclear power and other issues, I observed police violence fairly early in my life. And also, police violence is something truly international. Even in a country like Switzerland, where, you know, crime numbers are pretty low, there is police violence, like in many other countries. And it is this observation of violence inflicted on peaceful protesters and others that really piqued my interest at a fairly early age. And then the other thing, I find it generally fascinating, that the relationship between the state and the people who live in the state, and how these power dynamics are playing out. And I find it really important that there is no abuse of power, and police violence is abuse of power.
So tell us what happened. You go to law school over there, and then you move here. And what'd you do when you got here?
When I got here, you know, first of all, I have a family, so I had a 10-year-old daughter, and so my first responsibility when we moved here, because, you know, moving across the Atlantic is a big deal. So I really felt that I needed to create a new home for our family, and then I started fairly quickly. I started to look into what I could do to be able to practice here in the States. And then I started to volunteer for the National Police Accountability Project. So that's how I found the organization. And I was fascinated by the incredible work that these attorneys did and that the organization did. And so after a little longer, I was applying. When the position became available, I was applying for the position of executive director.
And the rest is history. You've been with us how many years?
I started in December 2006.
Almost
lucky,
8 years. Yeah.
7 years.
And yep. It's been a wonderful period for MPAP. And we wanted to let our listeners know, if they're interested in learning more, what's the website?
The website is www.nlg-npap.org. Or www.npapjustice.org.
Okay. We'll link with lawanddisorder.org to your website, Brigitte.
That would be great. Thank you so
Brigitte
much.
Brigitte Keller, thank you so much.
Thank
for
you
being
for having me.
You're truly a lawyer you'll like. Thanks for being on
thank
the show.
You. Thank you so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Thank you.
We now go to hear a segment of a speech from Anna Culcott, New Yorkers Against the Cornell-Technion Partnership. Anna will supply background information on the conception and planning of the Cornell-Technion campus in New York City, along with reasons to oppose the Technion, including its deep-rooted ties with the Israeli weapons industry and military, the growth of the anti-Technion campaign, and what needs to be done next.
Anna is a New York City resident who, in response to hearing that Cornell University was partnering with an Israeli institution, helped form New Yorkers Against the Cornell-Technion Partnership, or NIACT, in 2012, which has become the focus of her activism. In response to the Palestinian call for the academic boycott of Israel, NIACT campaigns for an end to the partnership of Cornell University and New York City with Technion. Through street protests, public talks, press articles, and online social media, NIACT has helped counter the mainstream discourse by exposing Technion's involvement in Israel's illegal occupation and oppression of Palestinians. As part of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions BDS movement, NIACT works at the local level within a global network.
So, as some of you may know, in December 2010, Mayor Bloomberg announced a competition to build a massive 2.1 million square foot applied sciences and engineering campus in Manhattan. And he was offering $100 million in our taxpayer money and free land for this campus. Various universities then made bids, including Stanford University, who were front runners until close to the end. However, as we all now know, Cornell University and the Technion Israel Institute of Technology won the competition. So behind closed doors, Technion and Cornell had come to an agreement to enter the competition as a partnership. And this was decided without consulting the staff, faculty, or students at Cornell, which is actually in violation of their own bylaws. And it was done with as little information as possible being given out about Technion. The two universities waited until 10 days before the city's deadline for proposals to reveal their union publicly. And then the winning bid was announced in December 2011. And it's now known as Cornell NYC Tech or Cornell Tech. And since then, reporting on the campus has scarcely mentioned the involvement of Technion, despite Cornell claiming that it was the inclusion of Technion that enabled them to win the bid. So the proposed campus is to be built on prime real estate on Roosevelt Island, which, as it's been mentioned, is in the East River between the Upper East Side of Manhattan and Queens. And it will take about 25 years to construct, and it entails the demolition of Goldwater Hospital, which is a long-term care facility on the island. And it will include space for private companies as well on the campus. Since December 2012, this collaboration now includes Google, who donated free office space in their Chelsea building to house the collaboration until their first academic building is complete on Roosevelt Island in 2017. So New Yorkers Against the Cornell Technion Partnership, or NIACT, formed in February of 2012 to oppose the collaboration of Cornell and Technion. We formed in response to the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and in particular the call for an academic boycott of Israel. So we oppose any collaboration with any Israeli academic or cultural institute on the grounds that we don't support the whitewashing of Israeli apartheid. And whilst most Israeli universities are involved in one way or another in supporting Israeli apartheid and the occupation, Technion really is an extreme example, and certainly the most notorious and prestigious university or institute that cooperates with the Israeli military. Quoting from a New York Times article earlier this year, Yossi Vardi, who has founded or helped to found more than 60 companies in Israel and has 5 degrees from the Technion, states, "I can say without exaggeration that Israel could not have been built without the Technion. There is a Technion graduate behind practically every highway, desalinization plant, new missile technology, and startup company in the country." So why do we oppose Technion coming to New York City? I'm going to talk first about their connections with surveillance operations, and then I'll talk about their involvement with weapons development. So the American Technion Society, which is a kind of PR and fundraising outlet for Technion in New York City, stated in a YouTube video that the world often turns to Israel for surveillance, for anti-terror and surveillance technology, but where does Israel turn? The Technion. For example, the Technion's Faculty of Electrical Engineering has developed dehazing technologies which are used to improve surveillance images gathered by unmanned airborne drones. Technion works with a large number of companies in Israel and worldwide, and this includes collaborations between academic departments and the private sector to develop specific technologies. It includes having students work in partnership with the private sector on particular projects. They train the graduates that then go on to make up the workforce of companies, so the engineers, the CEOs, the vice presidents, and they invite companies to take part in graduate recruitment affairs on campus. There's already a visiting assistant professor from Technion teaching at Cornell Tech at the Google offices, and his department, in particular the computer science department at Technion, has a lot of collaborations with companies, including Rafael Advanced Defense Systems, Elbit Systems, which Reham has mentioned, and Google, as well as some less well-known companies such as Converse, Amdocs, and Checkpoint. And Technion also has close links with Verint and NICE Systems. So these less well-known companies are actually very interesting, and I'll go on to talk about them. NICE Systems, Converse, and Checkpoint are three of Israel's largest high-tech companies, and they're all influenced by technology developed by Unit 8200, which you may know is Israel's version of the NSA. They are involved in the surveillance of Palestinian phone and internet traffic. Checkpoint and NICE were founded by Unit 8200 alumni, and one of Converse's main products is based on the unit's technology. Converse develops and markets telecommunications software used, among other things, to direct airborne drones, and Checkpoint is an international provider of software and hardware products for IT security. The ironically named NICE Systems specializes in telephone voice recording, data security and surveillance, as well as systems that analyze this recorded data. NICE lists amongst its leading customers the New York Police Department and the Miami Police Department. Verint, which acquired Converse in February this year, is considered the world leader in electronic interception, and Amdocs is the world's largest billing service for telecommunications. Both companies are based in Israel and are heavily funded by the Israeli government, having connections to the Israeli military and intelligence, and both have major contracts with the US government. Verint and Amdocs form part of the backbone of the US government's domestic intelligence surveillance technology, and Verint was one of the companies to which the Verizon and AT&T outsourced their mass wiretapping of US citizens as orchestrated by the NSA since 2001. And Amdocs has been accused of wiretapping for which it was investigated by the FBI. Since 2006, Verint has worked with the US State Department's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs to carry out a mass telephone surveillance system in Mexico. According to Verint's Mexico website, police forces, national security, intelligence, and other government agencies can use these solutions as part of a large-scale system designed to generate evidence and intelligence. Verint is now headquartered on Long Island, and its president and CEO, a Technion graduate, has stated his enthusiastic support for the partnership of Technion with Cornell at a 2012 Israel Day event at the New York Stock Exchange. So Technion is also heavily involved in the research and development of military equipment, some of which has already been mentioned by other panel members. Specialists at Technion developed the remote control capabilities of the Caterpillar D9 tractor, which is the notorious armored bulldozer, an essential weapon of Israel's occupation, enabling the Israeli army to demolish approximately 25,000 Palestinian homes since 1967. This bulldozer performed remarkably during Operation Cast Lead, to quote an IDF officer, and is used by the Israeli military to destroy Palestinian homes, olive groves, and tunnels without any risk to its operators. As was mentioned before, the first modern drone was developed in Israel in 1973, and Israel has gone on to become the world's largest exporter of drones, as well as using drones to kill over 800 Palestinians between 2006 and 2011 alone. Technion developed a program specifically for the research and development of drone technology and includes in its achievements a weaponized bomb-carrying stealth drone and the 9-inch wingspan surveillance Dragonfly drone. Technion also has deep relations with two major military companies in Israel, Rafael Advanced Defense Systems, which is one of Israel's largest government-sponsored weapons manufacturers, and Elbit Systems, which has been mentioned before, which is one of Israel's biggest private weapons research companies. Rafael is famous for its armored hybrid armor protection system, which is used on the IDF's Merkava Mark IV main battle tank. Since 2001, Technion has had an MBA program tailored specifically for Rafael managers. Elbit is one of two main providers of the electronic detection fence, a key component of Israel's separation wall in the West Bank, which was ruled as being illegal by the International Court of Justice, the principal judicial organ of the United Nations. Elbit has also participated in the design of and provided surveillance technology for the US-Mexico border wall. Numerous agencies, as Rehan mentioned, have divested from Elbit due to their violation of human rights, including Norway's finance ministry, Denmark's largest financial institution, and Sweden's largest pension funds. In contrast, Technion established a center for the development of electro-optics in complete partnership with Elbit. Furthermore, Technion practices institutional discrimination against Palestinian students by severely restricting their freedom of speech and assembly, and rewarding those Jewish students who, unlike most Palestinians, perform compulsory military service. So how would Technion impact New York City and beyond? I'm going to read some of the descriptions that have been given about the proposed campus from the website of Cornell Tech. According to the website, instead of traditional departments, programs at the Cornell Tech campus will be organized around hubs, which will allow them to focus on generating technology to serve particular industry needs. Another unique aspect of the Cornell Tech program is that every student will have a mentor in industry, an industry mentor. The way in which Technion will formally be involved in the campus is through the Jacobs Technion Cornell Innovation Institute, the JTCII, which will be directed by Craig Gottsman, another Technion computer science professor. The institute will be responsible for a third of the academic activity on campus, and their hope is to build an ecosystem like Haifa's. Haifa is the city in Israel where Technion is based. So they hope to build an ecosystem like Haifa's, where industry and academics feed off each other. Their plan is to have interaction with industry facilitated through industrial liaisons who will forge and cultivate relationships between academic staff and the technology sector. These relationships will result in joint projects, sponsored research, and technology transfer from the campus to local industry. Industry mentors, entrepreneurs, and members of the venture capital community will be present on campus to help shape and guide students' industrial projects, some of which may lead to spin-off companies. So this makes it clear how the impact of Cornell Tech in the city will have far wider ranging effects than just the campus itself. And this is the first time that an Israeli institute has been involved in building a campus on US soil. So I don't think we can overstate the significance of Tekkion coming to New York City, being as it is an international hub of business and commerce. The acting consul general of Israel in New York stated that this is of strategic importance in terms of positioning Israel not only in America, but all over the world as a bastion of creativity and innovation. And Tekkion's senior executive vice president has stated, the relationships established will make it easier for Israeli entrepreneurs to gain access to US markets. So the academic boycott of Israel isn't only, or it is morally justified. When people ask, what about academic freedom? We have to ask not only whose freedom, but why should we elevate academic freedom above basic human rights? And crucially, the boycott is also strategically sound. Israel actively attempts to cover up its crimes by promoting its academic and technological achievements. And Israeli academic institutes, including Tekkion, rely on foreign investment. In 2011, the University of Johannesburg became the first to implement the academic boycott of Israel when it severed its links with Ben Gurion University, ending a 25-year relationship. In April this year, the general membership of the Association for Asian American Studies, as well as the Teachers Union of Ireland, both unanimously voted to support the boycott of Israeli universities, becoming respectively the first scholarly institution in the US and the first academic union in Europe to do so. And in June, the Federation of French-speaking students in Belgium, representing some 100,000 students from 25 institutions, voted to freeze relations with Israeli universities. Many world-renowned scholars have come out in favor of the boycott, including in June this year, Professor Stephen Hawking, who courageously boycotted Israel's presidential conference, and about which an editorial in the Boston Globe reported, the movement that Hawking has signed on to aims to place pressure on Israel through peaceful means. To see such a statement in a mainstream US broadsheet shows just how far things have come. The tide is turning, and these are just a handful of the victories that we've seen on campus. So we're not against education, jobs, science, and progress. We're against oppression, apartheid, discrimination, and the destruction of lives and homes. And we know that New York City needs jobs and education facilities, but surely these don't have to come at such a high price. Our campaign ultimately aims to get the City of New York administration and Cornell University to end their collaboration with Tekkion. And we need your help. We need to continue to raise awareness. Most people in New York still don't know about Tekkion. They know very little about their involvement, and they know even less about what Tekkion actually do. And most people would not support $100 million in their taxes going towards an institute that develops drones and practices discrimination on its home campus. We may not have the financial resources to stand up to the City of New York, but with enough support and with time, we will make a difference. So how can you help? There are many ways. You can come and join us. We have protests every 2 weeks at the Cornell Tech campus, which is at the Google offices now in Chelsea. We go there and we hold signs, we hand out information, we talk to the public. If you're concerned about this issue, you could write to your local paper, you could write to your student newsletter, your church paper, your community blog, or any other group that you're involved with. You could write to your elected officials and find out what they think about this. If you're already involved in activism of some sort, you could ask your activist friends what they think and see if you can tell them about what's happening. And as I'm sure it should have been made clear this evening, this issue doesn't just have to do with Israel-Palestine. It should be of interest to anyone involved in or concerned about militarization and surveillance as well. And if you would like help with any of this, if you want to speak to your local community group, your church, your mosque, your temple, you can get in touch with us. You can also look at all the resources that we have on our website, which include fully referenced reports, as well as there will be a transcript of this talk, especially if you couldn't hear me, that might be useful. And we will be uploading the video that's being filmed of all this evening's talks. Our website and our email address should be on the program that you've all been handed out. And if you want to get onto our announcements email list, you could sign up. There's a sign-up sheet at the door on the table. You can email us, and that will allow us to keep in touch with you and let you know about what we're doing and what you can take part in with us, the protests and events and so on. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter as well. And so we will be outside Google in Chelsea again this coming Tuesday from 5 till 7. We would love for people to come and join us. You're welcome to come, even if you just want to talk to us and find out more about what we're doing. So with that, on behalf of NIACS, I would like to thank everyone for coming, all of the people in the audience and the speakers, and also to say how great it is to be holding it here at Judson Memorial Church, which has a long history, as I'm sure many of you know, of working in social justice issues. And Terry's about to hand out a book. So they actually gave us this space for no charge at all. We would like to contribute something to give back to them. So we're just handing out a box if anyone would like to contribute.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Thank you.